Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
And here we are once again with good old fun stuff, LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I'm looking at my lovely co-host and partner in this show of crime, Miss Bobby Jean Bell in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, hey.
Hey, and I'm wearing, I chose an article of clothing from my wardrobe that was the closest I could get to a kimono for tonight's show.
A bathrobe would have worked probably.
Nice to see you, Jim.
Good to see you, Bobby. You know, I have to say that the other night we had like storm warnings come in, and we had like dust storms and thunder, and oh my God, the wind just howled through here. And last year when it did that, my section of my fence fell over, so I put it up with so many screws that the other section fell over. I did good. But no, my dog decided that she wanted to be scaredy dog and climbed up in mommy's lap. But I have a golden retriever. And in fact, you've met my golden retriever. And she's a great dog, but she's a scaredy dog. So, you know, she's just a wonderful, wonderful animal. Tomorrow is an anniversary of something, Bobby Jean.
Yes, it is.
Would you like to? And I'm honored that you named it after one of my novels.
Well, and I sent you the MP3 file in case you decided you wanted to hear the show. Tomorrow is the 145th anniversary, June 25, 1876, the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Yes.
Also known as the Battle of Greasy Grass and Custer's Last Stand. And, of course, a moment in history that has long threads that gets it there. And then continues to cause historians and tribal leaders and tourists and everybody who is at all interested in that topic. It always seems fresh and new, isn't it? There's always some new information that comes out, even 145 years later. So, yes, what was the name of that book you wrote?
Bugles in the Sun.
Yeah, and how did you come upon that name?
Well, I ran across a memoir by Charles Varnum, Lieutenant Charles Varnum. He was the chief of scouts for the 7th Cavalry. And during the battle, the big battle, he was on Reno Hill with Reno and Benteen and five companies of 7th Cavalry. And as the battle ended and he was out walking the battlefield with several people from Crooks and the other unit that came in, General Terry, he saw these shiny things, and they were scattered throughout the battlefield, and he was kind of curious as to what they were, so he walked up on them, and they were the bugles laying out there, because the 7th Cavalry, they had to, every single day, they had to do leather maintenance, saddle maintenance, and buglers, which there were seven in each company, had to polish these bugles to just a brilliant shine. And brass, if you don't have brass cleaner, it's really hard to keep these bugles polished. So our guest is shaking her head, knowing that the Japanese have a lot of brass and it's miserable to try to keep it all polished. So that's what he found. And he just noticed that they were golden specks in the sun. And mm-hmm. so I just called the book Bugles in the Sun because that's the first thing you saw.
Mm-hmm. So I did a radio show that I do once a week on a station called online station by American Radio. My Out West Hour tomorrow is devoted to music of that both time period as well as contemporary music written and inspired by that event. And I called it Googles in the Sun. It was just the very best name to give to it. Thank you very much, Mr. Christina. So
thank you so much, Ms. Bell, for using it. I do have to say that when I wrote this particular book, I did it bass backwards. I did not write about the officers. I did not write about anything. I wrote it from the trooper's perspective.
Yeah.
And it's the beginning of each chapter is a journal entry from one of the troopers in I Company. And he is the only one in the book. The book is peppered with real people. And he's the only one that is a fictional character because, of course, he wrote the diary and the journal that each chapter opens with. But I really had a good time writing that, but it was a lot of research. And I wanted to make it as basic and as real and as authentic as I possibly could.
Yep, so, and you did.
Why, thank you. Thank you so much. And tonight... Yeah. Well, let me get to next week's guest because we're gonna I'm not gonna be here when it comes time to introduce him. Next week we have a gentleman from Texas. He's an ex-lawman. He's still a lawman. He's a lawman up under the state agency now up in the northern what they used to call the Llano Estacado, which is now the Panhandle of Texas. This is his second novel, his second Western book, and we'll be talking about next week. And it's unfortunately 408 pages.
Well, that's not much longer than tonight's book. We'll get that done, no problem.
Oh, well. And his name, appropriately, is John Lane. So, and if somebody can catch a difference there, I'm happy to tell you what it is. Anyway, he'll be with us next week. And tonight, we have a writer that is, this is her second novel. She's a new novelist. She's done a lot of academic writing in her lifetime. This is her second novel. She is the daughter of missionaries that were stationed in Japan. She's spent a lot of time in Japan. She went back. I actually spent 4 months in Japan, and I absolutely loved it. Of course, I had 4 months of drunkenness. So I have to say that I do nothing in Japan besides drink and carouse. But I was 20 years old, too, so...
sounds like a character from the book.
Focus almost exclusively on modern Japanese women writers and their battles against conservative literary expectations, and they're wonderful at their at times subversive creativity. I can believe that, knowing some Japanese women. She has translated the works of writer Unio Kyo Chio and novelist Kirino Natsuo. Her translation of Kirino's The Goddess Chronicle won the Penn Translates Award and the U.S. Friendship Commission Prize for the Translation of Japanese Literature 2014-2015. I'm going to let her tell you the rest about herself and this novel tonight, which is The Kimono Tattoo. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The Kimono Tattoo.
Yeah. Okay. Give a resounding welcome to the writer's block. Miss very special Rebecca Copeland.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate that you had me on the show tonight. It's always a treat to talk about your work, right? So I'm delighted.
Writers, especially, we tend to love to talk about ourselves and our work. So
you covered a lot already in your introduction, so I'm not sure how much I can add. But you're absolutely right. I'm a professor of Japanese literature with focus on women writers and a translator. And at some point about 12 years ago, I just decided I wanted to shift gears a little bit and try to write fiction myself. I have worked on the criticism of fiction, right? I teach it. So I thought, well, you know, I'd like to try to write my own novel. And I was really inspired by writers like Sujata Masi. She's an American writer, South Asian background, who has set a number of novels in Japan. And she has an Asian American amateur sleuth. And in the process of sort of investigating the various crimes that the characters come up against, readers get to discover more about the country that where the story is set. And I thought, well, that would be a great way to maybe sort of shift my academic focus into fiction. And so the kimono tattoo is the result of that effort.
Now you include, there's a lot of Japanese names in this book, and you know, not being I even though I was in Japan for 4 years or 4 months, I learned somewhat that the Japanese names are backwards. And it's really hard to remember that. I had a there was a lady that worked for us in my unit that I saw in the morning when I got there and before I left to go drink during the day. And she came in and she was absolutely a knockout. She, her name was Kumiko Ishii. And she would ugly herself down during the day. And then at night when she got ready to catch the shuttle back down to the bus station in Shitose, she would put on the makeup and do the hair. And the, oh, my God, you wouldn't even think it was the same woman.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the Japanese women that work on American bases do that.
Yeah.
I think it's they don't get catcalls and they don't get bothered by the men. And, you know, but I learned that the hard syllable is the front of the name. Mm-hmm. Ishii. And then the softer syllables towards the end. And so it's kind of hard to remember that, but you're going to get into names. And right now I'm going to leave you ladies to chat. I am feeling under the weather tonight, so I'm going to bag out, but I so appreciate you being with us tonight, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Honestly, a treat to have you.
And thanks for the introduction.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Actually, I read what you wrote. So if it's a lie, all your friends will be. So have fun, ladies. And Bobby Jean?
Yeah.
Take it away. She's all yours.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jim. So, Rebecca, we're so happy, as Jim said, to have you with us tonight. And we're talking about your book, The Kimono. I'm not saying kimono even, right, am I?
That sounds great.
Yeah, kimono tattoo. There's, you know, the publicity that goes out about the book got my eye immediately. Silk unravels, a tattoo is forever. Layer by layer, the truth is revealed. Oh my goodness, the trip you take us on. The layers of this book, and I know we don't want to do spoiler alerts and such, but as we talk about the book and also your process of composing this book, the layers and layers and layers, the places you take us, the sights and sounds and smells and the foods and the, you know, wine and beer and what is eaten, the traditions that you introduce us to, for those of us that are, this was alien world to me, totally. Is just so well worth the read. And I was confused many times, not because of something you as the writer did or didn't do, but because there's so much going on and you take us down one path and then I'm like, okay, I got this. Okay. Oh, what is she doing now?
Switch up.
Tell us, if you would, much more interesting to hear you speak than me. Tell us a little bit about this book and the main character, Ruth, as a way to just kind of get started. Just give us a little background on the book and then introduce Ruth to us.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for noticing the layers. I think that's an important aspect of the book and of Ruth. And so Ruth Bennett is an American. But she grew up in Kyoto because her parents were missionaries. And she travels back to the United States as an adult and tries to make her way in the world, but is just pushed back at each time. She fails at her career. She was a professor of Japanese literature, but she doesn't get tenure. And then she fails at marriage. And feeling just defeated, she returns to the only home she really knows, which is Kyoto. And there she sort of licks her wounds and tries to find a reaffirmation, I guess. She takes a job as a translator in a translation agency. So not very exciting documents. She's translating computer manuals and cell phone advertisements and things like that. And She's fine with that. She likes her, she wants to have just a boring life. She doesn't want to be noticed. But then suddenly this woman appears on her doorstep and invites her to translate a novel by an author who has not been heard of for over 20 years. And people think, most people think he's dead. And Ruth is flattered that someone would think she was worthy enough for this task. And so she agrees to take the translation on, even though it's kind of strange that you would translate a novel in English before it's been published in Japanese. And and she's not even sure it's finished. She only gets one chapter.
Yeah. And it was interesting that partly the reason she appears to be chosen is because of a translation she's done of another book. And tell us a little bit about that. I won't pronounce her name correctly, but she's a very interesting character, as yes. is that book. Again, I'm trying to avoid spoiler alerts, but she's an important character, and then she's introduced fairly quickly in the story. Tell us about her and about that book.
So Ruth, while she was a professor, she undertook a translation of a book called The Killer Kimono. And it's historical fiction written by a woman named Date. Date is her last name. And Date is a very colorful middle-aged woman who seems to have a preference for very young men and lives a very charmed life with lots of parties and fun. But she's a serious writer, and she writes this novel, historical fiction, about a kimono that was designed by a young apprentice in an effort to impress his boss and impress his girlfriend. But before he can present the kimono to the empress, it is irreparably damaged by one of his rivals, and that basically kills him. And so the kimono then takes on this persona as a killer kimono, because it destroys the young apprentice, it drives his girlfriend crazy, and it eventually goes on to get other revenge later.
And it's the time period for that story with that kimono is not current time.
Right.
But that story, it's one of those first things that sort of links to this story, not only because of the author connection and that she translated it and she's friendly with the woman that wrote it, but we kind of begin to understand that that kimono is connected to a very important, a remnant of it is connected to the story that you're weaving for us.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. So it's historical fiction. So there actually was a kimono.
That was the question I had. Thank you. Jump right in there.
In the novel, there actually was a kimono, and it becomes sort of the talisman for a prestigious kimono family. And it so happens that the author, the long-lost author who has written the novel that Ruth is then asked to translate at the beginning of our Vash story, is the heir to that kimono family. So both of these stories we find are linked, and they're linked through the kimono. And so that's one of the layers that we have to unravel in the novel.
I think as the story unfolds and then folds up again, and then we unfold it again, I really felt without feeling like it was contrived, or that you, the author, was looking for ways to use terms about textiles and weaving and the elements of a kimono, the obi, you know, sash and such, that you were very deftly weaving them into the story, so very subtly. And yet I also appreciated that you did, because my reader, I'm not an author, my reader mind is saying, oh, that's so cool because that connects to yada, yada, yada from, you know, three chapters ago. It is written in the first person. So we're experiencing the whole book through Ruth's eyes. Yes.
For the most part.
For the most part.
You know, I mean, she is the reader to us of the other novels that we encounter, the other stories within the story.
Yeah. Right? She is, besides this, we have some different plot lines. So besides this one, we learn more and more and more about Ruth's background. And I also love the way you illuminate it a little at a time. You give us little pieces, little snapshots, and again, they get woven in, and then we realize there is a big overall plot with a very sinister person.
Yeah.
And so we have that plot line. We also have sort of the whole mystery of the kimono itself and its history. And we have that very sinister person and that person's history. So you're taking us on multiple levels that all work together, which I really enjoyed. Let's see, what time are we at? We always need to take a couple of breaks, Rebecca, to thank our sponsors. And I don't know, Ronan, if you are listening, could we have LA Talk Radio now? We'll give Ronan a moment and see if he can pop that
Jim
on.
Jim, Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says Be a Host, and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say, and if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com, and listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the Writer's Block. Right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we're back. We're talking this evening with author Rebecca Copeland, and we're just having a great time. I hope you're having a great time.
I am, sure.
Partly, I think what I also enjoy as a reader and not knowing the culture at all are a lot of the elements that you add in that are just part of Ruth's day that we may not be aware of. Lots of little details. For instance, when you walk into someone's home, what is expected of you?
So you should take off your shoes, right? And usually when you're visiting somebody, of course, we do in the States as well, you bring a little gift, right? Mm-hmm. You want to bring flowers or a little cake or something. And before you enter the house proper, you remove your shoes, and it's, you know, that's just required. There's no question about it. And then once you've taken your shoes off, you need to sort of turn around and arrange them so that they're not just helter skelter in the mm-hmm. floorway. So Ruth has pretty good manners, and she manages to acquit herself pretty well with those daily activities.
Another part of the story, and something, again, I knew nothing about. Well, actually, let's take a moment and talk about kimono.
Okay.
Who wears them? Obviously, there's different ways to wear them. There's undergarments to them. Just maybe give us a little bit about kimono.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, fewer and fewer people in Japan are wearing kimono now. And the story is set in Kyoto, and you see a lot more people wearing kimono in Kyoto than you do in other cities because there's still so many more aspects of traditional art being performed in Kyoto. So people wear kimono if they're performing the traditional arts. And so Ruth is studying dance, so she has to wear kimono, and she wears kimono on her way to her dance class normally. So nowadays, most women wear kimono for weddings or for a special occasion, but not often enough to feel comfortable in putting the kimono on by themselves. And so if they have an opportunity to wear a kimono, they often have to go to a salon to be dressed appropriately. And so then that makes people nervous that are they going to wear it wrong? You know, is it tight? Is it not comfortable? And we get the impression then that kimono is a very uncomfortable, restrictive garment. But in fact, people wore kimono all the time up until like the 20th century, men and women. And you were just as active as you needed to be in a kimono. It didn't need to be restrictive. Another thing about kimono now is that in Kyoto particularly, there are places where you can rent kimono and they will dress you in kimono and then you can run around in the city in kimono. And a lot of people do that. You don't have to be Japanese. I mean, tourists do that. It's very, very popular.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was interesting that Ruth would look at her wardrobe of kimono to decide which one would be the proper one to wear for, you know, whatever if she had one that was proper for whatever event she maybe, you know, was going to. And we also learn that they come in all different value, some can be very, very costly. And so I enjoyed all of just learning about that. Now, let me just, I have to just look at my notes for a minute because besides kimono, tattoo.
That's so, right. There is a tattoo.
The title is The Kimono
Tattoo.
And oh my goodness, again, know nothing about tattoos. So the tattoo in this book, the gentleman who was the tattoo artist, tell us a little bit about, again, no spoiler alerts, but there is a particular woman. Tell us a little bit about her and her relationship with her tattoo artist. And maybe just a little bit about just even tattoo and how it relates to the kimono in this book.
So when Ruth begins to read this novel that she's been asked to translate, she's only a few pages in when she encounters a scene where there's a woman who is lying along a riverbed. And it's growing dark, it's hard to see, and the narrator of the scene can't quite see who the woman is, and he comes closer and thinks she's wearing kimono. But when he gets close enough, he realizes she's not wearing kimono, she's not wearing anything. She's tattooed, and her tattoo resembles the fabric of a kimono. And so Ruth is surprised by this scene, and she wonders, is it really possible to have a tattoo that looks like the fabric of a kimono? And she just so happens to have a really good friend named Maho, who grew up in the United States. Maho grew up in California. So she and Ruth are kind of the opposite of one another. Ruth grew up in Japan and is more comfortable in Japan. Maho grew up in California and is more comfortable in the United States. Maho has a lot of tattoos. So
and piercings. Yeah,
and
mohawk.
And a mohawk. Yeah, she's
fun.
Just,
she's a lot of fun.
A lot of my early readers really liked Maho better than Ruth. I mean, Ruth's kind of staid, you know, but she's sort of normal. But Maho is just really colorful. So Maho says that she will take Ruth to meet her tattooist, in Japanese, a horishi, to get information about the...
Say it again.
Horishi.
Horishi. Okay.
and so she takes Ruth to meet the tattooist. Tattoos in Japan are typically not visible. People who have tattoos don't usually flaunt them because there's a lot of bias against people who wear tattoos. They're often considered members of the underworld, of the Yakuza, and so usually proper ladies don't wear tattoos. So Ruth, again, is surprised that this woman is all tattooed. So the tattooist is very cagey. When Ruth begins to explain the tattoo, he becomes very angry or upset and warns Ruth not to pursue this matter any further. And so that then leaves Ruth even more confused. You know, is there really a person that has this tattoo? Is this person really dead? Is she aware of a crime now? So she has to get answers. And the more answers she gets, or the more she asks questions, the more she finds herself getting in trouble.
Yeah, and it's sort of happenstance that actually the tattoo artist she's speaking with is actually involved with the woman that has the tattoos. And again, no spoiler alert, but it's fascinating because it's about a 12 years of, I think about 12 years for the artwork to get to the point it is at.
That's
when
right.
when we meet this woman, and I think, oh my gosh. And these are very detailed. Well, I guess, tattoos are, but very detailed. And we also learned that she was very specific about what she wanted and how she wanted and the colors and all that she wanted. So I think that was really interesting.
Well, the tattoo is designed after an actual Japanese screen. This is a real one that's in the Chicago Institute of Art. And it's a real screen that is by a 17th century artist. And that's what the tattoo resembles.
Yeah. And sorry, I'm just setting up the next ad. Excuse me for a moment.
Okay.
So talk a minute. We just talked about the friend, Maho, is that how we said her name?
Maho.
And then she has, of course, her sort of significant other at the time is Hawk, and he's kind of the connection. He kind of is connected too. He's another really great guy. Tell us a little bit about Hawk.
So Hawk, his real name is Taka, but in the English translation of Taka is Hawk, and so Maho calls him Hawk. She has a mohawk, so she figures they're meant for each other. And he is the apprentice to a woodblock print artist. The woodblock print artist is the brother of the tattooist. And so there's a similarity between the way these two arts are sort of performed. And anyway, so the Hawk is able to get some information to help Ruth from his job as the apprentice to the woodblock print artist. And he and Maho are really helpful friends. They're really good friends to Ruth. She couldn't have solved the case without them.
No, not. They're very supportive of her. Let's see, what time are we at? Oh, we got another minute or two. I also really like, is it Hiro? Hiro?
Hiro.
And he has a kind of an interesting backstory. Just maybe introduce us a little bit to this gentleman.
Sure. So Hiro is the son of the owner of the translation agency, Mrs. Shibasaki. And Mrs. Shibasaki lived in Texas for a while. And so her English is impeccable. And she is running this translation agency. And Hiro, her adult son, is supposed to be helping her. He doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He appears to be very lazy. So when Ruth is at the agency, she feels like she has to work extra to sort of cover up for Hiro's mistakes. But as she gets to know him, she finds that he has a lot of layers, right? There's a lot of to his personality, and he's not the cad that she thought he was in the beginning. And so that's another element of the layering of the novel, is that Ruth and the other characters wonder, you know, like what creates their identity? What makes Ruth American and Maho Japanese? You know, there's identity is layered. It's not something that we wear. It's not even something on our skin. It's something much deeper. So you have to pull the layers away.
Which you do beautifully. Okay, let's see. Ronan, how about the Tuscany Bay Books ad right now, if you have that queued up and ready to go?
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now, what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published, and right now we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we're back with Rebecca Copeland. We're talking about the kimono tattoo. I always want to say the kimono killer because of that other book, but to remind myself to say the right name. We're going to start talking about process in a moment, but to prepare for tonight, you know, I went back. I don't take any, when I read to prepare, Rebecca, I don't take any notes or anything. I don't read reviews. I just sit down with the book. And then afterwards I go back and I try to find kind of character names because that helps me remember the action and whatever. So when I did that tonight, as I told you, I had just finished the very last page. Yeah. And so I'm going back to the very first page and the first line of the book, we are introduced to a parasol, a white parasol. And a woman who you just Ruth sees and Ruth describes to us and to herself. And at the very end of the book, we have a white parasol. It's still not a spoiler alert, but we have a white parasol. And we have a woman of maybe the same age. She's wearing a different kimono. I think she's in a purple kimono. And I thought to myself, so will there be a sequel?
I hope so. Yes. I'm not done with Ruth. She's not done with me. So I'm working my way through the second book. And what I'd really like to do is let Ruth travel a little bit in Japan. So the second book is also set in Kyoto, but I would like her to go to other areas of Japan and discover more murders. Sadly, people have to die.
Whoa, everywhere Ruth goes.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. But I was born in Fukuoka, which is in the southern island of Japan, Kyushu. So I would like to send Ruth to Fukuoka, and that place is also famous for weaving, but also for dolls, for making dolls, and pottery, all kinds of things.
All kinds of arts. So,
yeah. So wonderful. Ruth will have to translate more artworks.
Wonderful. And I could see, I don't know what your plans are, but I could see a few of those characters maybe still being present, could yes. be present. I also think they could have books of their own, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. Mahou's, again, so colorful. In the second book, Hawk is more prominent.
Okay. So let's just shift a little bit into process, because we love to talk to authors. We know that a lot of our audience maybe are new authors or authors that could be stuck in a rut. And so we really look to all of our guests to help talk a little, you know, about your own process. Now, if I recall correctly, when did you start writing this book?
I actually started in 2012. So it was a long time ago.
Long time ago. So were you working on it all along, or did you pick it up and put it down because life got in the way, or kind of how was that journey over the 12?
Right. So in 2012, I had a sabbatical leave from university duties, and that freed me to really devote myself to planning the novel and thinking about the novel. And so I spent that year mostly working on the novel, and I went to Japan in the summer of 2013 to sort of ground myself in the place where the novel was set. But then I returned to full-time teaching and lost my momentum. I'm so compartmentalized, I can't do too many things at the same time. And when I'm teaching, my brain just shifts into a different mode. And I don't know how people really, I don't know how writers carry a full-time job and write prolifically. But I would write during the summer when I was freed of the teaching duties for the most part. And so I wrote the first draft and then put that away I finished the first draft, I think, in 2014. I put that away, and then I had some people read it. I came back to it, and eventually I had a draft that I was ready to show to agents in 2018. So it still was a very long process. Yeah. And
go ahead. No,
I was going to say I was not successful with an agent, so I eventually wrote directly to the publisher that I am fortunate to be working with, Brother Mockingbird. And my publisher, Melissa, said, you know, I'm interested, but it's too long. It was too long. I think it was, at this point, it was 117,000 words, and I had brought it down from 124. I mean, I had way too much exposition. I still have a lot of exposition in the novel, but she said, you know, can you cut it? And I had already cut, so I felt like I can't go further. I know it needs to be cut, but I can't go further. So I hired an editor, Johnny Bernhardt, and she was amazing. Yes,
yeah, we love
for good
her.
Reason.
Yeah,
and she cut it down to 99,000, yeah. And in the process, she really sped up the narrative arc. You know, it just reads so much better, and so that was 2020, and then we went from there.
So all of the plot lines and all of the various mysteries that get unraveled and solved. Did you have all of those as you were writing, or when you were writing, as you're going along, you go, oh, I should bring in something about those dogs, you know, that fight. Oh, I should bring in, or did you have all that?
And no, you knew that was gonna I wish I had all that. I wish I were so organized. You know, I tried to outline. The people talk about being a plotter or a pantser, right? I really tried to plot it out in the beginning. I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never written a novel. And so I thought, I have to have an outline. And I studiously sat there and tried to plot it out. But that just stymied me. I couldn't go forward as long as I was trying to create a framework. So I started writing the characters, and I wrote the backstories for the characters. And oh man, Ruth has such a backstory. I even practically wrote her dissertation. You know, I got so deep into Ruth's backstory. And then I would just walk around with the characters. I'm a runner. So after I would work for a while, I would go out for a run, and the characters would run along with me and talk.
And
you know, when you're running, you kind of get into a zone, and you're not your brain kind of shuts down, and then magical things start to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
before we go to our final break for the evening, and as I'm looking at time, the one question that we always ask every show is, do you experience writer's block? If you do, how do you get around it? If you don't, what do you think about it?
So I definitely have writer's block. And while I'm in the process of writing, I try to write something else. Like I said, I couldn't really write the scheme, the framework. So I wrote about Ruth, or I will try to write a scene instead of being linear in my writing. And I find that helps me break through. Or I will, like I said, go take a run. I'll go take a hot bath, you know, something to sort of change the synapses in your brain a little bit, so things fire differently.
Yeah, that's there are pearls of wisdom in those words. And with that, Roman, if we could have the creative edge spot, we would appreciate it.
Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know, there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge. Yes, it's true, and no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market, offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And we're back. And I can't believe how quickly this hour has gone. 50 minutes has gone. But I have, I've been very interested. I watch a lot of PBS, and they have the National Storytelling Project, Share a Story. And in order to help people share a story, they've got a whole long list of wonderful opening questions. And I thought it would be fun to just ask you a couple of these. And if you go, oh, I can't answer that one, that's fine. For instance, at this point in my life,
At this point in my life, I am so happy to be where I am, and I'm so looking forward to retirement.
Okay, here's another one. What keeps me up at night is ...
Fortunately, I don't have too much insomnia, but what keeps me up at night is often wondering how I'm going to fix a particular issue that I've been worrying over.
Let's see. This is my favorite time of year because...
I love the summer. I mean, summer's... I'm in St. Louis. Summers in St. Louis are brutally hot. I grew up with hot summers, and I love the summer.
Okay, and the last one is, the tradition I carry on is, if you have one.
I think the tradition that I carry on for my family is caring about other people.
And if there was anything that you'd love to share with readers or with new writers from your experience, just something off the top of your head, what would that be?
I think to trust yourself and try to shut out the voices in your head and the voices that are telling you what you can and cannot do, and just try to trust yourself to do what you want to do with your writing.
That's great. And where can people get this book and learn more about you? And I know you blog, so tell us tell us how your fans can find you, your new fans can find you.
So my website is www.rebecca-copeland.com. And so it's Rebecca-Copeland.com.
And I was reading your blog.
Okay.
I'm looking at time. We only have a couple of minutes left, but you have a project coming up that's releasing, or did it release?
It did. It just came
out. It's out.
Yeah.
You want to just say something very quick about it? A little teaser, so we'll all go to your website.
It's a collection of chapters, essays on the Yamamba, or the Japanese mountain witch. And these are stories about how she inspires us to create.
Okay. And it's a edited, you're one of the editors?
I'm a co-editor. And I also have a little story called The Blue Ridge Yamamba. The Yamamba is a Japanese witch, but she doesn't let oceans stop her. She came all the way to the Blue Ridge.
Let's see. Okay. Are you on social media, or is it just your website?
Also have a Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
Okay.
So the Rebecca Copeland author on Facebook.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. And so we can expect that there may be a sequel coming out, or another Ruth-centered book.
Yes. I hope so.
Do you have any sense of when that might be?
It'll be a while. This took me 10 years. It'll take another 8 years probably.
You don't want to wait that long.
I know. And they keep telling me, you know, you'll get quicker, you'll get faster once you get used to it. So hopefully I will, now that I have the first one out.
Well, congratulations on getting this one out and on the new book that just came out. And we really, really, Rebecca, want to thank you for being with us tonight. This will be a podcast. It'll be available in probably like 5 minutes on the LA Talk Radio Writer's Block website. And then we post it on our Facebook page, and I post it on my personal website and such. So we'll make sure to get you the link so you can embed it. But we really, really congratulate you, and we look forward to reading the next books and staying in touch with you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you for wearing that beautiful blouse. It looks very kimono-esque.
The last time I wore it was to a wedding, and we were supposed to wear, you know, and I've had it for a very long time, but I just can't part with it. It's so beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's just perfect.
You. Thank you so much. Again, congratulations. And on behalf of Jim, Christina, and Sam Hassan, and Ronan Rosner, and Richard Polinelli, and Russ Avison, our host Jim Christina, and our bookie, who we couldn't do it without her, Jerry Christina, as our host Jim Christina says every week, and we are out of here. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye. Thank you.